Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Ricky Wojcik and Jane Merrilt from Aspen High School, and they will be interviewing Yael Shadmi, Professor of Physics at Technion, the Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa. Yael got her bachelor's degree in physics and math from Tel Aviv University and her PhD from Stanford. She had one postdoc at Fermilab near Chicago, and her second postdoc was divided between Princeton University and the Weizmann Institute in Israel. She's been on the faculty of the Technion Physics Department since 2001 and heads a technological particle physics group. Here are some of the fundamental questions driving the Shadmi research group. Are there new fundamental particles beyond the known quarks, leptons, and gauge bosons? Are these known particles indeed fundamental? What sets the mass scale of the Higgs? Why is the weak force so much stronger than gravity? Why is the electron so much lighter than the tau? What is dark matter made of? Are bosons and fermions related by an approximate symmetry, supersymmetry? Big questions. We'll start talking about some of them. Who would like to start?
Yael, thank you for joining us today. Jane and I are both taking physics in high school, so it's of great interest to both of us as to how you decided to become a physicist. Were you always interested in physics, or did that come a little later?
I think it came fairly late. I mean, I was interested in everything. I had all sorts of dreams as a kid growing up. I wanted to do biology, be an architect, an astronaut, a linguist, you name it, all sorts of things. I don't think it ever occurred to me to become a scientist until I was in 11th grade. In high school, I started taking physics in 9th grade, and I really liked it. I guess my teacher in 9th and 10th grade didn't exactly think girls were meant to do science, so he wasn't terribly encouraging. And my parents had to come to the school to make sure that I can get into advanced physics in 11th grade. But then I had this amazing teacher, and I just completely fell in love with the subject. He really showed us the beauty of physics and the elegance. And from that moment on, I think it was pretty clear that that's what I wanted to do.
And what convinced you wanted to study high-energy particle physics, of all things?
That was actually a pretty negative motivation. So during my undergraduate years, we had to take some introductory courses in different fields, like introduction to condensed matter physics and astrophysics. And the one that I understood the least was introduction to particle physics. And it sounded very strange. It sounded like these people were playing games, and it just didn't make sense to me. And I thought, okay, this cannot be this dumb. There must be something behind this that I don't understand. And so I better learn some more and see what this is all about. And this is not an accident. I mean, the problem is that high energy physics requires pretty advanced formalism. So before you learn the formalism, things sound like people are telling stories or playing some sort of games. And I think this is something that happens to many, many students at the beginning. It's kind of hard to understand the real formalism behind the stories. And so I decided to learn more, and then I decided I really loved it, and so just went on with it.
You've already talked a little bit about how in high school you were affected by men and thinking that women shouldn't be in sciences. What other challenges have you faced being a woman in science and being kind of a minority?
I haven't encountered any overt, except for this teacher in high school, perhaps. There wasn't any overt negative attitude towards me or towards women in general. I think it's just a little harder in many different little ways. Just because you're different, and so, you know, we're all very human. We all have our biases. We all have some idea in our heads about who looks like a physicist and who doesn't. So this was certainly there, I think, both in the way that I thought about myself and what were my chances of becoming a scientist, getting a job in academia, these sorts of things. I think girls usually tend to doubt themselves a little more than boys do. So that's there. I think it is a little more difficult, probably, for girls and for women. But I think it's something that's certainly surmountable, and I think it's totally worth it. I mean, I think that as you become more established in the field, it gets better and better.
Speaking of challenges, I imagine there are plenty of new discoveries to be made in particle physics, and that can seem very, very daunting, especially with a very limited set of things we know right now. How do you continue to motivate yourself to tackle all of these huge issues?
That's a great question. I think I'm certainly hoping for new discoveries. I mean, right now we're at the stage where we have an amazing machine where we can probe the highest energies possible to date. So in principle, there's the potential of lots of new discoveries. That's the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC at CERN. There are also many, many other experiments looking at cosmological data, all sorts of satellites, and tabletop experiments looking for new particles. But for me, the main interesting place is the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. And we're at the point where there's no loss of theoretical ideas. So we're very creative. We have many different possibilities that we think could be lurking there. And we have to think very, very hard about how to discover them, because the LHC environment is a very complicated one. There's lots of stuff going on, and you're really looking for the needle in the haystack.
When you're looking for that needle in the haystack, do you think you're looking for things that are wrong with theories, or do you think that you're looking for the correct things in theories?
So we have a very beautiful theory. It has a terrible name. It's called the standard model, and there's nothing standard about it, and it's not a model. It's the theory of the fundamental interactions, so it's very unique. But there's some, I would say, deficiencies about it. Some are very, very clear problems, observational problems. For example, it doesn't account for dark matter, and we have very good evidence the dark matter is there. We see matter around us. We don't see any antimatter. It doesn't explain that. So these are some very concrete problems. Then there are some more theoretical problems. For example, there's the Higgs particle that this theory predicted, and its mass is, there's no explanation for why its mass is so small or so much smaller than the most fundamental scale we know, which is the Planck scale. So that's a more theoretical problem, but nonetheless, it's a real problem. So we're looking for things that would solve all of these problems and maybe produce to the LHC. And of course, you know, having said that, we should always bear in mind that perhaps we're totally misguided and we're looking in the wrong directions. And given that we have some experimental possibilities to explore different things, we should just be very, very open-minded, think about all sorts of different things that we may discover there. And it's very hard, because if you think of, okay, you want to discover a new particle, you have no idea what the new particle is going to be. And depending on the properties of the new particle, the way it would manifest itself in experiment could be very different. So you have to sort of think about the unknown and try to look for the unknown.
So why did we go to the LHC to search for this? What pointed us in that direction instead of some other?
So the first thing that the LHC already accomplished is to discover the Higgs, which was predicted. But basically the reason that it's such a powerful way to discover new things is that it can go to very, very high energies. So you collide two protons, you accelerate them to speeds that are almost the speed of light. So they're incredibly energetic. And the amazing thing about this is that you can make new particles in this way. So it's like a magician pulling out a rabbit off the hat, right? So the rabbit wasn't there before and suddenly it's here. So you can ask, how is this possible? And the reason this is possible is what everyone knows, the t-shirts that say E equals MC squared, Einstein's thing. It's the fact that energy can be converted into matter. So you take these very energetic particles and you can convert some of the energy to new particles that weren't there before. That's the truly amazing thing about the combination of quantum mechanics and relativity, is that you can have a collision between two particles, and the final state, what you have in the beginning are two particles, what you have at the end are completely different particles, as long as energy is conserved, momentum is conserved, charge is conserved. As long as you conserve all these things, everything is allowed. So you can make completely new particles that weren't there before. So if you're looking for new heavy particles that may be unstable, you can collide two other particles, and if you have enough energy, you can produce these new things. So particle accelerators are the best way, or the most immediate way you can think of in order to produce new particles.
So all of this seems kind of overwhelming based on what we've learned in physics. What would you tell young physicists is advice for us furthering our physics knowledge in school and stuff?
I think you want to learn, you want to spend a lot of effort understanding things very well. And when I say that, I think it's very important to question everything that you were told. And one thing that I think is very important is to remember that physics is an experimental science. And sometimes you read a textbook and it seems like, okay, that textbook descended from the heavens somehow. And, you know, everything is so crisp and crystal clear and the theory is so beautiful. But that's not the way science works. I mean, what really happens is that scientists wander in the dark. They have no idea about what's going on. And it takes a very long time and usually a great deal of experimental information for things to crystallize. And suddenly you see the light. But it's not, usually it's not one person. It's a very, very cumulative effort. So I think with everything that you learn, you want to ask yourself, how do we know that? I mean, you're told the photon is massless. How do we know that? You're told that the charge of a particle and its antiparticle is the same. For example, the electron and the positron. How do we know that? And usually, if you're interested in history, then there's a very long history to each one of these questions. But even if you're not interested in history, you really want to understand how do we know the things that we claim we know? And the name of the game, at least in my field, is really to stretch these boundaries and take any of these given things that we supposedly know and put a question mark on it. And usually the question is, how well do we know this? So for example, if we're asking about, is the charge of the electron and the positron, or the electron and the proton, are they the same up to a sign? So there's some limit on that. I mean, there are experiments that look at that, and you can tell that they're the same with a certain precision. And perhaps if we're able to go beyond this precision, if we have better experiments, then we'll discover that something is not as it seems. Because and many times that's the way things advance, is you have a set of rules that apply as long as you can do certain experiments and go to certain energies or velocities. And once you go beyond that, things don't hold anymore and need to be corrected.
So what have you been doing with your time here in Aspen, and what do you hope to do with your remaining week?
So I've been mainly thinking about dark matter here in Aspen. So we know there is dark matter around us, and we know it's and the reason we say it's dark is that we know it doesn't have any electromagnetic interaction, or we would see it. It would be visible to us through photons and the electromagnetic interaction. And it's probably some, it could very well be some sort of new particle that's massive and is neutral, so it doesn't have electric charge. But aside from that, we really don't know what are its interactions, except for the fact that it interacts gravitationally. And so one of the one possibility that people have been interested in lately is that it's something that has strong interactions, very similar to the strong force that we know, but perhaps a different strong force that we haven't discovered yet. And so the main question that I've been thinking about here is, suppose you have a stable particle that's charged under this strong force, what is it going to do as the universe evolves? So these particles originally are produced in the hot bath. The universe is very hot, and there's this very hot soup of particles, all of the fundamental particles that we know. And if there's any new stable particle, it just stays there, and we can calculate what it does as the universe evolves. So it has all sorts of interactions with the other particles around it, and the universe keeps expanding, so it becomes harder and harder for two particles to find each other and interact. And we can actually we can actually calculate the number of these particles that would remain to this day. So that's essentially the problem that I'm thinking about. What would be the fate of this particle? How many of these guys would stay around? Can it be a good dark matter candidate? And this is something, and depending on the exact properties of this guy, this is something that we may or may not be able to produce at the LHC. And actually, maybe one thing that's worth emphasizing is that, you know, the particle physics is very, very relevant to cosmology, because when the universe was very young, it was very, very small and very, very hot. So you're talking about very short distances and very high energies. And that's precisely the realm of particle physics. It's very energetic things and very small distances. So relativistic quantum mechanics, if you will.
Can you describe a little bit what the process would be of coming up with a theory after, or like from one of these questions that you have and trying to answer here?
So this is one direction of research that I've been working on. Another is thinking about supersymmetric extensions of the Standard Model. And in each of these, these directions, the way things work is that there are some difficulties, there are some open questions. And you're sort of trying to come up with new particles and interactions that would solve these problems. Now, in many of these cases, none of this is totally new. It's not something that I invented from scratch, you know, yesterday morning. This is a very mature field. So in many cases, people have thought about theories of this type for quite some time. But then you realize that perhaps some of the things that people have thought about so far are not the things that are actually happening, and some of the assumptions that they were making can be relaxed. Or you want to think about, can we have a variant of this theory that would predict a very different behavior of a particle in the Large Hadron Collider? So I can give you one simple example, perhaps for the Large Hadron Collider. So people have been thinking a lot about supersymmetric theories. And usually the option that they concentrated on was that the lightest supersymmetric particle, the lightest new particle, is neutral. And then when it's produced at the LHC and it goes through the LHC detectors, it would just go undetected because it's totally invisible, because it hardly interacts with the material in the detector. So then what you see is what you don't see. you have some missing energy. In other words, you look at the momentum, the initial momentum and the momentum in the final state, and they're not the same. So you know something was produced and it escaped. So that's one possibility, which is very interesting. But then working on these theories, you realize, well, there's actually a whole set of models that would predict that the lightest supersymmetric particle is actually charged, and it could be very long-lived. So then you have a very, very different signature. There's something that's charged, and it's moving through the entire detector at the LHC, and it looks almost like a muon, but it's much heavier than a muon. So you should be, if the experimentalist should be prepared for this possibility. You need to design your experiment and detector differently or interpret the results differently. So that's one possibility. Or this thing that I just mentioned with a dark matter guy. People used to think of dark matter particles as something very boring that just interacts gravitationally. But then you can say, well, what if this guy has new strong interactions and it maybe forms a bound state, just like the proton is made up of quarks. Some of these new dark matter particles form a bound object. And then it can do all sorts of things in the early universe, and perhaps it can have some observable consequences now. So it's you're just trying to think about variants of existing theories, things that people have not thought about before.
So you would try and measure dark matter using those strong weak forces? Or would that be more similar to measure dark matter? Would you do the same thing as you're doing with the supersymmetry, looking for something that's not there?
There's two sorts of, or there are various different ways to look for dark matter. One is directly by building some detector on Earth and waiting for some dark matter particle to come and hit the detector and see the signature of that. Then there are indirect ways by seeing a dark matter particle and its antiparticle annihilating somewhere and looking for the end products of that. So, for example, these guys would annihilate, give two photons, and then you'll be seeing these photons. And yet another one is the LHC. You'll just if these particles are charged under the interactions that we know, the interactions that normal matter feels, the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic interaction, then you can also produce them at the LHC. So whether or not these guys have these new sort of interaction that I was describing could affect any of these experiments. And it could also have some cosmological consequences. For example, it could alter the we know how much dark matter we need roughly, and we can predict the amount of dark matter that will be left if the dark matter particle has a certain mass and certain couplings. In this different scenario that I'm talking about, this prediction would change dramatically. So then, instead of having a certain allowed dark matter mass, I can have much heavier dark matter, for example. And that means that when I design experiments that try to look at dark matter directly, I should also be looking at that range of masses. Then there are other possible consequences of this, which would affect dark matter interactions and what it does in the early days of the universe.
It seems like we're looking for things that aren't really there and that are incredibly small. So how do we possibly have the technology to look for this, and how precise is that technology? Is it reliable?
Yeah, I think that the technology is absolutely amazing. I mean, if you look at the Large Hadron Collider, it's probably the most complicated and advanced thing that humanity ever built. I mean, it's really quite amazing, and its detectors are very, very precise. The first thing that's done when you start working with that is to make sure that you reproduce all the known physics, everything that you've measured so far, you can measure again and very, very precisely. So I think the technology is certainly there, as far as we know. Of course, there could be something that we didn't think about, but the technology is there. And to some extent, now it's really a matter of waiting to gather more and more data and to make sure that they were very creative in the way that we use our detectors and think about different analyses that we can do to look at what's there.
Thank you very much, Yael Chatmi from Technion in Israel, and Jane Rurald and Ricky Wojcik from Aspen High School. Tune in to Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. And for more information about our Gopher program and events at the center, please visit the Aspen Center for Physics website at aspenphys.org.